The Word of Mouth podcast from NHPR is made possible with support from you, our subscribers, and from
Heinemann, a provider of resources written by real teachers for real classrooms. Heinemann values teachers as decision makers and students as curious learners. Discover the path to lifelong professional learning at Heinemann.com. Heinemann, dedicated to teachers.
This is Word of Mouth. I'm Erica Janik. We have two stories for you today, one about something very near to us, and the other, a wild salamander that calls Mexico home. Up first, the Executive Council. What is it, and why does New Hampshire have one? Here's Civics 101 co-host Nick Capodice.
America! Government. Separation of powers. Look, you know this, but it's important. So our federal government is split into the three branches, legislative, executive, and judicial. The legislative branch, which is the House and Senate, the judicial branch, which is the Supreme Court, and the executive, which is our president and vice president. I am already picturing the angry calls to the station. I'm so sorry. But our state government follows the exact same model. So here in New Hampshire, we have the legislative, which proposes all the bills, those little laws to be, and it's made up of our 24 Senate seats and our 400 House of Representatives seats, and our judiciary, which is our Supreme Court and other courts, and finally, our executive branch, which is the governor, who signs bills into law. In some states, you got a lieutenant governor, too. And that's it, right? Well, in classic New Hampshire style, we do things crazy different.
We're the only state in the nation that has a functioning executive council.
There are five additional members of our executive branch.
Massachusetts has a ceremonial one, but ours has real authority and should be to our advantage when the governor works with us.
This is Andrew Valinsky. He's one of the five members of the executive council, which he once called the most powerful body in New Hampshire that no one knows about. Can you explain to me your current cell phone greeting?
Yeah.
Hey, this is Andy Valinsky. Thanks for calling. If you're calling because you have been nominated to a government position and you are trying to reach me as an executive counselor, please understand that I must review 20 or 25 nominees each week. Please feel free to send me an email.
It's my cell phone. So I have one cell phone, and the governor's office instructs everyone who's nominated to every position in state government to contact their counselors.
Because they're always in their districts, they are available to all constituents, to their towns, to their cities, government. They're available to everybody by their cell phones. My name is Dana Laviano. I am the executive secretary to the executive council. I am the only full-time member or full-time employee for the executive council. I sort of run the office for all the counselors.
And are they here now, or where is everyone?
No, most of the time the counselors are in their own districts. Most of them have full-time professions, and so that keeps them busy as well as them working as counselors within their districts. Executive counselors are elected for two-year terms, same as the governor, and their two-year terms run concurrent with the governor's term. And they are just sort of another layer of citizen representation within the within the executive branch. We have had an executive council since New Hampshire became since it was a colony. King Charles II decided to break New Hampshire off from the Massachusetts Bay Colony.
Wait, hold on a minute here. King Charles II? The 1600s. Yep. Looks like it's time for a
New Hampshire History Minute.
I just made that up. That's not going to be a real thing. But here's how it all went down. The colony and eventual state of New Hampshire has a long and complicated history. Specifically, when it comes to our relationship with our old friend, Massachusetts.
Ooh.
I know.
Yikes.
See, in the 1600s, we went from being separate from Massachusetts to being a part of Massachusetts, and then in 1641, being governed by Massachusetts, but all established towns were self-ruled. And finally, in 1679, Charles II issued a charter that separated New Hampshire from the Massachusetts Bay Colony. And there's a whole lot more there, but we're just focusing on the Executive Council here. When Charles split us in twain, he elected a president of New Hampshire, which is later called himself a governor, named John Cutt, and a 9-man council. Now, this might have been a mistake on Charlie Dew's part, because while John Cutt usually agreed with whatever the king said, his 9-man council did not. As a matter of fact, in their first assembly, the council enacted laws that were directly opposite to the wishes of the British crown. So while today the council serves as a check on the governor, they used to check the King of England himself. Can you get more New Hampshire than that? Jeezum crow.
And that has it has been in place ever since.
What is the role of the executive council?
The job of the executive council is to act as a board of directors to steward mostly the economy of New Hampshire. We do more on the business side of things than on the policy side. And we're constitutionally designed to be a check on the power of the governor. So there are a lot of powers that the governor has where he can or she can initiate the action, but then 3 out of the 5 councilors have to confirm the action for it to take place.
The executive council has authority over all state contracts valued at $25,000 or greater.
Can you give me an example of a state contract?
Sure. If somebody's going to, say the Department of Transportation wants to hire a company to resurface some roads, section of roads.
Frost heaves going crazy. They want to fix the roads
exactly.
up.
Exactly. And so they will want to enter into a contract with a company. They have to put out a bid. They have to, you know, get the different contracts. They choose somebody. Then they put that to the council and ask for the council's okay. And the council has to vote yes or no.
Okay. And are the votes ever like just barely split down the middle, or do they usually go one way or the other?
Well, it's a 3-2 because there's 5 members. So so somebody's always the swing vote. But most of the time, most of the contracts go through fine. But the councilors have a lot of responsibility. They get all the contract paperwork for all the contracts on every agenda. They get that the Friday before the Wednesday meeting. And it's their responsibility to review all that paperwork. And I'll tell you, they review it all. They will have gone through it. They will have questions. And all of that takes place during the governor and council meetings.
So we have 5 days to read the materials. I read all the materials I get. 2 of us read them on our iPads and bring the little iPads to the meetings with us. 3 of the current counselors get printed copies of the materials delivered to them on Fridays by the state police.
Oh, wow, because they're secret, or they're not secret.
They're not secret, but you're not supposed to get them until that Friday.
Right.
And they don't want to delay it in the mail because we have to vote on Wednesday. And so Councillor Kenny from District 1 sits between the governor and me, and when he puts his pile of paper on the council table, it's sometimes hard for the governor to see me. And I think I'm the one he's most worried about on the council. So often in our meetings, he's peeking around the edge of Councillor Kenny's pile of paper.
You're hiding behind the pile. But how much paper are we talking? Just how much stuff do you have to review?
The agendas get longer as you get closer to the end of the fiscal year because everyone's trying to get in before the deadline.
So we're in it right now.
We're in that now. We could have 300 items on our agenda in June, which is 2 or 3 feet worth of paper. So it's a long weekend. So we approve contracts.
Yeah.
We confirm nominees. So the governor has the power to nominate judges, department heads, all of the volunteers who populate the many commissions and committees around the state. The governor brings forward their names. We get resumes. We have phone conversations with the nominees, and then we come in and vote again on the Wednesday morning meeting.
Could you give me some hypotheticals of situations where somebody would want should call you?
They don't have to be hypothetical. There's a dam being taken down by the Department of Transportation in the Durham area. People are concerned about that. Called a culvert in East Concord.
What's a culvert?
Culvert along the side of the road where water flows off the road and it's caught and goes to a storm drainage.
Right.
Seemed to be overflowing and affecting a farmer's field. I was called about that. People hear that a certain person is nominated to be a judge or a department head. They've had interactions, good or bad.
Right.
I get called on that kind of thing. People should know what we're doing because of the $6 billion state budget. We approved the expenditure of about $2
billion. Wow.
So people should pay attention, right? Our agendas are online at the Secretary of State. So if you hit New Hampshire Executive Council in your browser, you'll come to our webpage. There's a bunch of information, including the agendas every Friday, every other Friday. Since I help confirm the heads of every state agency, they tend to take my calls. And so if a citizen has a difficulty with a state agency, doesn't understand what they're doing or why they're doing it, I can usually get that answered for them. I may not be able to change the decision because there may be good reason for it, but I can usually intercede to get a question answered. I'm also the highest elected state office holder for the Democrats, Chris Pappas and I, the two executive counselors. So we have some leadership roles in that area. I'm not very political, so I don't go very far in that direction, but I get some of those calls.
Well, thank you so much, Councilor Polinsky.
My pleasure.
And I hope you get a lot of call after June 6th.
Okay, thank you.
So there it is, the Executive Council. Yet another way that you, as a New Hampshire citizen, can get involved with your government. Go to their website, nh.gov/council, to read their agendas, see who your counselor is, see what they're voting on. You can read minutes of previous meetings going all the way back to 1989. And if you go to their meetings, I just might see you there. I'm just going to see the giant stack of paper.
Our next story comes from Outside In producer Justine Paradise.
Fue su quietud la que me hizo inclinarme fascinado la primera vez que vi a los Axolotl. Oscuramente me pareció comprender su voluntad secreta, abolir el espacio y el tiempo con una inmovilidad indiferente. Después supe mejor la contracción de las branquias, el tanteo de las finas patas en las piedras, la repentina natación. Algunos de ellos nadan con la simple ondulación del cuerpo. Me probó que eran capaces de evadirse de ese sopor mineral en el que pasan horas enteras. Sus ojos, sobre todo, me obsesionaban. Al lado de ellos, en los restantes acuarios, diversos peces me mostraban la simple estupidez de sus hermosos ojos semejantes a los nuestros. Los ojos del Axolotl me decían de la presencia de una vida diferente, de otra manera de mirar.
This is Luis Zambrano. Well, I am a biologist and an ecologist.
He is an ecologist from Mexico City.
And that's our producer, Justine Paradise. We spoke to Luis together.
So this moment was actually really special for me because this short story that Luis just read from is one of my favorite short stories, and we got to hear it in its original Spanish. The story is called Axolotl by the Argentinian writer Julio Cortázar, and it's how I found out about this animal, the axolotl. The story is kind of in magical realist tradition, and it's about a man who becomes kind of perilously obsessed with this creature, which is also known as the Mexican salamander.
Well, the axolotl is a salamander. It's an amphibian, actually. It's like a large, chubby lizard. And at the behind her head or his head, it has the gills. It has a crown of gills.
So these gills are really striking, and like Louise said, they sort of look like a crown or a mane, like maybe kind of like they're made of coral. It's also got this big head and tiny eyes and a perfect little smile.
When they stare at you, which happened with Julio Cortázar in the story, it's a very, very funny and interesting moment. It's something happens between you and the animal.
Luis started studying the axolotl about 15 years ago.
Well, I've heard in English is axolotl, and ajolote is in the Spanish version.
Yeah, because I think that just phonetically, having only ever read the word, I always pronounced it axolotl.
Okay. Well, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I really don't know how you can pronounce in English.
No, it's definitely wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
So axolotls are unusual for a couple different reasons. First, they never reach adulthood, but remain in a perpetual state of what's called neoteny.
Kind of like a permanent tadpole that never becomes a frog?
Right, eternal youth. So that's the first reason that they're unusual. And the second peculiar power they have is that they have this ability to regenerate their limbs. So for instance, if a limb is amputated, they can regrow it perfectly. Not only structures like arms or legs, but they can also do that with like their spinal cord. So the axolotl is significant for humans because of that regenerative ability, so that it's got medical and scientific potential.
Well, it's just very supernatural. It's very godlike.
Yes.
¿Qué tiene de especial? Híjole, qué pregunta tan compleja, tan difícil.
This is Felipe Barrera.
Mira, mi nombre es Felipe Barrera. Soy productor chinampero. Soy chinampero y tengo 42 años.
He is a farmer in Mexico City who works with Luis, more on that later. And as he'll explain, the name axolotl actually comes from the Aztec god, Xolotl.
Pues el ajolote culturalmente es importante para todos nosotros, para todos los Xochimilcas, es la representación del dios Xolotl.
The monstrous dog, god of heavenly fire, of lightning, and the underworld. He is the renegade twin brother of Quetzalcoatl, the plumed serpent, god of wind and rain, and of creation.
Es la dualidad de Quetzalcóatl. Es la noche, el día, el bien, el mal. Entonces, pues tiene ahí un significado bien fuerte, bien profundo, ¿no?
This duality, Felipe says, of night and day, of Xolotl and Quetzalcóatl, is the mythos contained in the axolotl.
Esa dualidad sería terrible perderlas. Sería como desaparecer, desaparecer nosotros mismos, ¿no? Transformarnos en no sé qué cosa.
This is the animal of Mexico. I don't care about eagles, I don't care about jaguars. This is the animal that has to represent Mexico. So I fall in love.
You're listening to Outside In, a show about the natural world and how we use it. I'm Sam Evans-Brown. And today, our producer Justine Paradise has the story of a symbol of Mexico, an animal which, long before it was depicted by artists like writer Julio Cortázar, was celebrated in Aztec origin stories. But the wild axolotl's fate might be bound to the Aztecs by more than myth. Its life in the 21st century might rely on a landscape both very old and very human.
So I hate when I go to the Google and then I put axolotls and the first picture that appears is the baby-like pinky axolotl, which is nothing to do with the real ones, basically.
This is Luis Zambrano again, the axolotl ecologist.
Pink axolotls are albino axolotls, such as albino tigers that you will see in Las Vegas. But they are not the real axolotls. I mean, normal axolotls, the wild axolotls, are darker, are really, really dark, actually. They are almost black, greenish, brownish black, with a lot of spots. If you see an axolotl that has been grown in a tank and an axolotl that has been grown in Xochimilco, you will see a difference between a dog and a wolf.
The difference between a dog and a wolf. And the wild axolotl lives only in one place, the last remaining fragments of Lake Xochimilco. It's in a neighborhood of Mexico City, one of the densest and largest cities in the world. Now, Xochimilco means a few different things here. It's the name of one of the Nahuatl tribes of Mexico, the Xochimilcas. It's also the name of the lake itself, which, as you'll hear, is actually more like a wetland canal system. And it's the name of that neighborhood within Mexico City. Xochimilco the lake was once part of an interconnected chain of lakes, together known as Texcoco, in the Valley of Mexico, which is a high volcanic basin riddled with springs. The system is endorheic, which means there's no outlet. It doesn't drain to the ocean. So these lakes were kind of like islands in reverse, dynamic but isolated ecosystems, beautiful conditions for endemism, which means a species that evolves for just one unique place in the world and nowhere else. And the axolotl is one of these endemic species of Mexico.
Well, there is one of these theories that the Aztecs became a really, really important empire and one of the most important in America before the Spanish came because of this area, actually.
The Xochimilcas realized that the mud at the bottom of the lake wetland system was incredibly fertile and could be gathered during the dry season to create what are known as floating gardens, or chinampas. This started as early as 1000 BCE, and it was an incredibly productive form of agriculture.
The same thing happens in Egypt, for example, or in China, or in Mesopotamia. Once you solve the problem of food, then you can start to think in other things, such as culture, and create a huge empire.
In 1325, the Aztecs took over the Xochimilcas and their floating garden technique, and then proceeded to dominate large parts of Mexico and Central America. One paper I read said at their peak, the floating gardens themselves supported 100,000 people in the capital city.
So the relation between the Aztecs and the lake is really, really important. Within the lake is the axolotl, and my hypothesis, I don't know if it is true, and it's those type of hypotheses that you never cannot be tested, is that when they created these islands, these chinampas, these floating gardens, they increased the habitat of the axolotl. So the axolotl was happy before the Aztecs arrived. When they arrived, they were happier.
According to this theory, the axolotls thrived and multiplied and became symbols of Aztec civilization, smiling, chubby little lizard gods, drifting uncannily in the maze of chinampas. But then, colonialism.
And that's what the Spanish arrived to see, right? This maze.
Mm-hmm. The Spanish, when they arrived, actually they got into the city through that area.
So when Hernán Cortés and his conquistadors showed up in 1519 from Spain, they were stunned by these floating gardens. Cortés actually wrote about them.
Check, check, check. This is Jimmy G as a colonizer. When we saw all those towns and villages built in the water, and other great towns on the dry land, and then straight and level causeways leading to Mexico, we were astounded. Those great towns and buildings rising from the water, all made of stone, seemed like an enchanted vision. Indeed, some of our soldiers asked whether it was not all a dream. It was so wonderful that I do not know how to describe the first glimpse of things never heard of, seen, or dreamed of before.
And in this colonizing, 16th century Spanish naturalist Francisco Hernandez noticed the axolotl, and he named it Piscis ludicrus, or ludicrous fish. But in short order, of course, true to form, the Spanish conquistadors slaughtered the citizens and infected the entire city with smallpox.
Well, basically, the Spanish, after the conquest and they started to colonize, they changed one of the most important relationships with nature that Aztecs used to have, I mean, in terms of water.
In Mexico City, there's a powerful rainy season, and without proper water management, you'll have flooding. The Aztecs had designed their network of canals with this in mind, to absorb these fluctuations. But the Spanish...
They decided to dry out the lake. And the few survival areas were like Xochimilco. So they kept Xochimilco in order to be sure that they will have food enough for the civilization. But the number of these islands were reduced really in high numbers.
And then skipping ahead a few centuries.
That was a sort of, in some way, okay. until late 50s of the last century, in which the expansion of Mexico City was huge. And since then, we are worried that we can lose Xochimilco because of urbanization.
I'm looking at a map right now, and it's really striking because you've just got incredibly dense city all around it, and then this just island of water and canals.
Yeah, it's completely surrounded by urbanization at this moment. Xochimilco, as it is a very interesting place, is also a highly touristic attraction for many people, foreigners and Mexicans. And there is a huge area in which you are, as a tourist, you can go there, and you will see a lot of huge boats that are highly characteristic, and everybody, I think, internationally have seen these boats called trajineras.
If you haven't experienced the trajineras, don't worry. There are plenty of travel vloggers who have made their experiences available on YouTube.
These huge boats are flat and with a small roof and with flowers in the front of these roofs, and then you will hear a lot of mariachis. The first time I went to Xochimilco as an adulthood, when it was in that area. So I said Xochimilco is lost.
Really crowded and not as relaxing as I thought it'd be. Well, yeah, just loud. Kind of like a fiesta on the river.
That is not the real Xochimilco.
But there is this other part of the lake, quieter, with fewer tourist boats, a place with more chinampas, the floating gardens that still survive 2,000 years after they came to be. This part of Xochimilco, in the southern outskirts of Mexico City, is not far from the university where Luis worked. And it's there that in 2003, Luis conducted his first census of that wild axolotl population.
It is very funny because I refer to those moments as when you have a very, very bad first date and then suddenly you fall in love with your partner, something like that. That happened to me with the axolotl. When I started to make this research for the National Commission of Biodiversity in Mexico, it was awful because it was very, very difficult to catch them, and still is very, very difficult to catch them.
At first they tried gill nets, then minnow traps.
But that didn't work at all in the first census. So basically the thing we do is that we are in these boats for tourists, but now it's for research. They don't have flowers at the top of the roof, but they're still working.
What?
No alcoholic beverages.
Not drinking tequila.
And then at the front of the boat goes a local fisherman that knows how the axolotl make bubbles when they go up to breathe. It's a different type of bubble that other bubbles that appear in the system.
So every 200 meters, this fisherman would throw a cast net into the water. This is a circular weighted net that drops to the bottom of the canal. And in the middle, if they saw a bubble that looked like an axolotl bubble, this fisherman would also throw the net in order to try to catch one. So before Luis did his survey, there was one other scientist who had begun studying axolotl ecology. Her name was Virginia Graue. And in 1998, her research suggested that there were about 6,000 axolotls per square kilometer in Xochimilco. So in 2003, Luis and his research team set off in their flowerless boats, saw the bubbles, cast their cast nets, and calculated that the population had diminished from 6,000 to 1,000 per kilometer squared. And then same thing, 5 years later, in 2008, the boats, the bubbles, the cast nets. And they found that the numbers had fallen still further, from 1,000 to 100 per kilometer squared.
But the worst was in 2014. I mean, because we spent about 4 months and we didn't find anyone. And it was something like, okay, our calculations were wrong and now they are extinct. Fortunately, we found one at the end of that study. So we said, okay, they're still there.
Sorry to interrupt, but in 2014, yeah, the entire census, you found one axolotl?
Yeah.
And then you extrapolate that to 36 you said per...
Organisms per kilometer
but
squared.
But you just found, the experience was you found one.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah, we found one. I mean, we saw three or four more, but we found one only.
It's hard to laugh. You
know, no, yeah.
Yeah, it's a, yeah, I know it's a nervous laugh, but...
yeah.
Yeah. If we don't do anything, the axolotl will be completely extinct in the wild in the, in 2025, something like that.
But what could they do about it?
Y sembramos muchas hortalizas, ¿eh? Tenemos creo como 20.
And you were hearing Victor Velasco, who's showing us his garden in Xochimilco.
Broccoli, cilantro. Victor Velasco, mi edad son 61 años, y pues soy productor de hortaliza y productos lácteos.
Victor is 61 years old. He's a dairy farmer, and he grows vegetables on his chinampa, a floating garden in Xochimilco, the lake on whose sediments Mexico City is built, and the only place left in the world to find the axolotl, the Mexican salamander, alive in the wild. Victor actually remembers when the axolotl was abundant in Xochimilco.
Sí, incluso comerlos. De niño, había una costumbre, ya se ha perdido en las fiestas, hay muchos barrios.
He says, we used to eat them. When he was a kid, they'd go to neighborhood parties that would last for days, where they'd eat mitzmole.
El mitzmole, que es un guisado de tomate.
Spicy tomato soup, sometimes with axolotl.
Pues lo que era la ajolote, la cocina.
I've also read that axolotls were once wrapped and baked in corn husks, axolotl tamales. But Victor says people don't know about this mitzmole dish anymore.
Pues ya nadie, o muchos jóvenes ya no conocen.
That was back when the water quality was better, when axolotls were much more abundant, and long before axolotl ecologist Luis Zambrano had arrived on the scene to conduct his censuses, which told him the axolotl could be extinct in the wild by 2025 at the latest.
Okay. Well, at the beginning, I was a little bit depressed.
Luis has wanted to be a biologist since he was in third grade, and his family has spent the large part of the last 50 years in Mexico City. It's where he grew up.
I mean, I think that all the researchers that we are dealing with this type of things, in some moment we found a very, very ugly data that make us sad or stressed, basically. I've heard the story that the person that that found how the oceans will be more acid and then it will destroy all the coral reefs, when she saw the data, she had to stand up and go to throw up, I mean, to the bathroom because it was really, really stressful. So it didn't happen like that to me, but it was really, really sad. But after 2 or 3 months, I started to see that as a challenge, basically. It's something like when you see a huge mountain and you know that you have to climb it. That was my feeling in the following months. I mean, it's a huge challenge. I am hired at the university to solve the huge challenge, so let's do that.
The pressure on Xochimilco and on the axolotl were coming from a couple different sources. First, exotic species of fish, carp and tilapia.
Tilapia came from Africa and carp came from Asia, basically China. And they were
Luis says the history here is that carp and tilapia were introduced in Mexico in the 70s and 80s because the idea was these fish can reproduce fast, you can fish them, you can increase the access to protein for people that don't normally have that access in Mexico.
That didn't work but create a huge problem in terms of biodiversity in lakes and rivers in Mexico.
And for the axolotl, it meant that the carp ate their eggs and tilapia ate the juveniles. The second problem was the change in water quality. Xochimilco was once fed by springs, but as Mexico City grew and grew, the city diverted that spring water to meet the population's water demands instead. And in the 1950s...
Xochimilco ran out of water, or was close to be completely dry out, and the solution of the government was to introduce water from the treatment plant.
So wastewater.
Wastewater, yeah. Which is a problem because sometimes the treatment plant works and then the wastewater is with good quality, but sometimes doesn't work properly, and then the water is not particularly with good quality. And if we remember, axolotls are amphibians, and they are susceptible for changes in the water quality because they breathe through the skin, so the skin is very sensitive.
Plus, Luis says local governments began adopting new agricultural policies, encouraging the use of fertilizers and pesticides.
Ya son seis generaciones, estamos hablando de 200 años que pues mi familia ha estado aquí, ¿no? Desde entonces, y seguramente generaciones más atrás.
This is Felipe Barrera. You heard him at the top of the episode speaking about the duality of the Aztec gods. He says his family has been here six generations, 200 years. And when his father and grandfather started using agrochemicals in their plantings, it was on the advice of engineers. And as Felipe describes it, these engineers were selling a story about progress and modernity.
Les marearon la cabeza con este rollo de la modernidad y el resultado es este, ¿no? El Xochimilco que tenemos actualmente, que es un Xochimilco contaminado, pues que ya no es lo mismo que era antes, ¿no?
The result is a contaminated Xochimilco. Felipe says when he arrived to work on his family chinampa, it was a disaster.
Y pues me doy cuenta del desastre que había en la chinampa de mi padre, ¿no?
Practically unusable because of the use of those agrochemicals, which of course had also affected the ecosystem, killing both insects, the main diet of the axolotl, and also just directly killing axolotls. And the last big threat, Luis says, is the noise and bustle of the city.
Oh man, okay. This is the most interesting thing we may have ever done. And for being something...
Wild axolotls doesn't like people. They hide. They don't want to be around people or around noise, actually. Once they are surrounded by them, then they started to get ill and then they die after a lot of stress. So we found that these three huge threats, exotic species, water quality, and urbanization, are the causes of the reduction of the axolotl populations.
Despite all this, somehow the axolotl is still there. And thinking back to Luis's hypothesis, the idea that the creation of this very human landscape of the chinampas actually helped the axolotl, this is actually not all that far-fetched. In fact, ancient systems of agriculture often were good for certain wild species. In New England, for instance, Native Americans managed forests through controlled burns to encourage species like blueberries and deer. That was also true on the plains to manage for bison herds, with all kinds of ripple effects throughout the rest of the ecosystem. I mean, why do you think the axolotl is smiling anyway?
So the axolotl was happy before the Aztecs arrived. When they arrived, they were happier.
Today, there is no wild Xochimilco. The only thing left is the remnants of the chinampas, and most of them are abandoned.
Pues la información que hay en los libros es muy general, no hay información.
This is Carlos Uriel Zumano.
Carlos Uriel Zumano, soy colaborador del Laboratorio de Restauración Ecológica en el Instituto de Biología.
He's one of Luis's collaborators at the Institute of Biology at the National Autonomous University of Mexico. And he says there's no academic institution in the world that teaches this ancient style of agriculture, chinampería.
Te comentaba que no hay institución académica en el mundo que enseñe chinampería. Pues se aprende así por tradición, por enseñanza de los padres a los hijos, de los abuelos.
You learn by tradition to grow vegetables organically in polycultures, interplanted to support the soil and control pests naturally. But even though Xochimilco's Canal Chinampa system has been listed as a UNESCO World Heritage Site since 1987, when Luis was getting started, many of the chinampas were abandoned. Of the just over 2,000 square kilometers of remaining chinampas, only around 11% of them were still being farmed.
While I was working in terms of to find out which are the threats, a friend of mine started to work in Xochimilco, and he told me, I mean, if you want to restore axolotl's population, you have to work with local people because they know and they understand and they will work with the area before and after you leave, and they will work there even when the government changes or not. So we have to start to work with them.
But part of the problem is...
local people is completely tired about people like me, a scientist that goes there and then pays them very, very small amount of money to make a research and then leave.
For instance, government encouragement of chemical agriculture, which ended up degrading Xochimilco. Or one of the other major threats to the axolotl that Luis mentioned, the invasive carp and tilapia. They were actually introduced by the UN. Or you could draw this back to the Spanish conquistadors, who were completely awed by the chinampas, but still thought they had a superior water management strategy, and so they drained the lake and totally transformed the city. So if a family had been there for generations, they might have seen ideas come and go. Experts parachuting in, perhaps with PhDs, state titles, theories and grants, and they would have seen some projects fail and been left to live with the consequences. So it's into this environment that Luis, supported by the university and local government, comes in and pitches his idea to the Xochimilcas. Let's keep doing axolotl censuses, but let's do more than just sit by and watch. Let's work together, let's collaborate to revive more chinampas and grow organic vegetables in the polluted water and figure out how to create a refuge without carp and tilapia. What was the process like of recruiting locals to help you on this project? So, like, what were those conversations like?
Oh, they are really, really harsh, actually. The first meeting I had with local fishermen, the nicest thing they told me that it was like I was a really, really stupid guy, that I believe because I had a PhD, then that didn't mean that they knew anything about Xochimilco.
Part of Luis's strategy has just basically been to stick around, to not go away.
Was it, did you have to go have coffee with them? Was it in public meetings? Like, how did this happen?
All of that, plus get drunk with them. It's very important, actually, to go with them all the time, stay with them. I mean, the thing is, like, I can't do that all the time by myself, so I have a very nice team. They have to see you in the bad moments, in the work moments, when everybody is working really, really hard. And then you have to be with them working hard. And in the good moments, when all of them are drunk, and then you have to be drunk with them in order to see you are my brother, basically.
It took a few years, but together the Chinamperos and the Biological Institute started a project with the dual goal of increasing the amount of chinampas and the amount of axolotl.
Son las compuertas y tiene una, dos, tres, cuatro en este espacio.
And they created a refuge by constructing small barriers with water filters around the working chinampas.
3-4 meters barriers, mostly, in which carp and tilapia cannot get into.
O tener mejor control de la tilapia.
Simple but effective. One 2014 study found that water transparency went up by 50% in the refuge. It was working.
I mean, the island is alive, and we saw that the axolotls could survive very well. And not only axolotls, also native species such as crayfish and a small silverfish also.
Pues es así como se hace la chinampería. La chinampería no se puede hacer de forma individual. Es la chinampa es colectiva.
That's Felipe Barrera again, chinampero. He says the chinampería cannot be done individually. The chinampa is a collective.
Son varias generaciones que ya hemos crecido con ese discurso de la competitividad, de pasar sobre el vecino.
Felipe is saying that for a few generations, farming was defined by competition in Mexico City.
Competencia.
He also says that this is from the pressure of industrial agriculture on peasant farmers, big agriculture driving vegetable prices down. So he says the attitude in the community was, ignore your neighbor and get the best prices. And that has fractured the social fabric of Xochimilco.
Y eso también pues ha venido a fracturar mucho del tejido social que existía aquí en Xochimilco. Tradicionalmente, hace 500 años, las chinampas se construían en comunidad.
Felipe says 500 years ago, chinampas were built by hundreds of families coming together.
Esa fragmentación también es resultado de lo que tenemos actualmente.
But right now, Xochimilco is fragmented. Felipe says this is not just the story of Xochimilco.
La historia nada más de aquí de Xochimilco es la historia del campesinado en México.
It's the story of the campesino, the peasant farmer in Mexico, which
es un desastre, ¿no?
He says is a disaster. Ecologically, it looks like the refuge is a better place for axolotls. But the project itself is still small. Right now, there are just 10 working chinampas. Felipe says to return to the construction of that collaborative social fabric.
Entonces, volver a hacer ese, esa construcción del tejido social
will be a challenge.
Es un reto.
For him, the big question is how to find a dignified living through small-scale agriculture.
¿Cómo poder vivir de forma digna de la agricultura? Esa es la gran pregunta, ¿no?
I think that the most important thing of this is the change of the attitude. As a scientist, I don't go to teach them how to do the things. As a scientist, I go there to understand how this social ecosystem works and then help to make the process easier, and then receive their ideas and give another ideas and then generate new ideas from everybody. That is my role, and not to teach everybody because I knew everything. So that is the thing that increases the trust and has been increased the trust in the last years. It's not easy, but has been increasing the trust, basically.
Producción de alimentos. En términos biológicos es eso, muy importante. Es un indicador de que el ecosistema está en buen estado. Para los chinamperos.
Right now, Luis is in the process of seeking funding for their next axolotl census. If they get it, they'll be able to add 12 more chinampas as well. And like Carlos Uriel Zumano says, one of Luis's collaborators at the university, the axolotl are an indicator species, a sign that things are going well. But then we asked him, for you, the axolotl, why is the axolotl specifically important for you?
Para mí es importante porque en términos biológicos.
Carlos says again, you know, I'm saying axolotls, they're important as a biological indicator species, but.
Y porque en algún momento me gustaría probar un ajolote, ¿no?
He says at some point he'd love to try an axolotl.
Platico mucho con los chinamperos y.
He's talked a lot with the chinamperos, and they say.
Y ellos dicen que es muy rico. Que,
it's pretty delicious.
Que pues algún día tengo que probarlo. Para mí el día en el que se logre tener los ajolotes suficientes para poder comerlos otra vez, eso va a significar que pues por muchos años y por muchas generaciones más va a seguir existiendo.
Before we go, we've got a little something special for you. Over the last year or so, we've been working on sorting and cataloging our archives, no easy task, and Melinda Gill, our archivist, and Andrew Perella have run across some real gems that we thought would be fun to share with you periodically. This one is from the program Front Porch in 2005 with linguist Gay Gould from Plymouth State. She's speaking about the particular accent of the Northeast.
The most obvious thing about the New England speech pattern, I think, is the lack of the R afterwards.
How did that come to be, those dropped Rs?
Basically, from England, that post-vocalic, because it's after a vowel, that post-vocalic R wasn't a feature of the English that came here in the first place.
Another clip from Front Porch, this one from 2004 with author Mike Caduto, speaking about his book, A Time Before New Hampshire. He's describing here the western border of our state along the Connecticut River. That's the border of two tectonic plates.
Well, first off, the western border of New Hampshire along the Connecticut River is the ancestral border between two major tectonic plates. The North American plate, which would include North America and Greenland and Africa. So, and that's one thing I like to tell New Hampshireites is that many of them live on what was once part of what's now Africa.
Mm. And New Hampshire and Vermont have been different places for a long time.
For a very long time.
Thanks again to Melinda and Andrew for those archival gems from NHPR's past. that's it for Word of Mouth this week. Today's show was produced by Nick Capodice, Justine Paradise, Sam Evans-Brown, Hannah McCarthy, Taylor Quimby, Jimmy Gutierrez, and me, Erica Janik. Music from this week's episode came from Komiko, Yontarian, and Jazar. Outside In's theme is from Breakmaster Cylinder. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.
I guess, maybe can you describe what it's like to hold one?
Yeah, it's slammy. I mean, they're